Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and we're going to get right into this week's show in just a moment, a look over the last week's news. And yeah, it's been a very, very interesting week. And after that, it will be time for this week's sponsor interview with Jason Haddix of BugCrowd. He'll be along to talk a little bit more about what BugCrowd calls next generation pen tests. They claim one of their tests is sufficient for compliance purposes under PCI, ISO or NIST standards, and they've had a third-party auditor prove that for them. They also say this service has really taken off despite being launched only a couple of months ago, and that's this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to BugCrowd for sponsoring this week's episode of Risky Business. Oh, and I'll just mention this now, next week's show will be a day late due to some travel commitments, just so you know. But yeah, let's get into the news this week with Adam Boileau. And Adam, we've got some really great stuff to talk about this week, starting off with an espionage indictment against a former US Air Force counterintelligence officer named Monica Witt. And yeah, the reason we're talking about this on a security podcast is there is a real heavy like spearfishing and cybers angle on this one.
Yeah, this story actually goes back to 2013 when Monica Alfred Witt eventually defected to Iran. She worked in a bunch of intelligence functions for the U.S. Air Force and then helped the Iranians with a bunch of targeting against her previous colleagues, you know, helping them run phishing campaigns, setting up some of the identities that they used to break into, amongst other things, like a Facebook group that a bunch of Air Force intel people were using to, you know, chit-chat around Kandahar or whatever, which, you know, with some terrible phishing, I guess, which is one of the reasons we're talking about it on the show, because it was just so bad. But hey, bad things work.
Absolutely terrible. There was like, hey, baby, if you want to see my photo album, disable antivirus, because I had to make this album executable. And, you know, it's really amazing just how bad some of these Iranian phishing attempts were. But they actually got better and started like cloning profiles of people they knew to be real spooks. And then, yeah, infiltrating like Facebook groups for spies, which is like not a thing that I necessarily thought existed. And you know, the Gruck was actually all over Twitter, like pulling apart this indictment and tweeting the funny parts. And I mean, he had this to say about it.
Although like civilians like us tend to think that the security forces, like the intelligence community and so on, have amazingly good security and would never leak what they're associated with and everything, it turns out that they actually are human, and they tend to have things like Facebook groups for people that have worked in the same office, and Facebook groups for people that work the same role. I was commenting with a friend who's ex-IC about how amusing and bad this OPSEC was, and he was laughing and saying, yeah, can you believe those guys are on Facebook? Oh, wait, actually, I'm on a bunch of those groups. So I guess it turns out that there's actually a fairly large number of people that haven't thought through that what to them is just a job group is a counterintelligence bonanza for anyone else.
Yeah, so there you go. I mean, I'm starting to think that maybe it's time for people who work in jobs like that to start being a bit more careful, maybe get off LinkedIn. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty reasonable expectation, and especially as, you know, this kind of intel stuff really has, you know, I guess it's heated up, right? I mean, it's not the, you know, quite as underground, quite as small as it, you know, as it once was. And yeah, if you work any role in these organizations, and of course, there's all these peripherally related things, you know, the contractors, the Booz Allens, you know, that kind of thing that, you know, you're a target way beyond, oh, I work, you know, specifically for the Air Force, I work specifically for a security agency. You know, you have to take it a bit more seriously.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, Catalin Kimpanu of ZDNet, actually, I mean, he had this great pickup here where he spotted the names in the indictment and put it together that one of the hackers mentioned in this indictment was actually the same one behind the hack of, like, Game of Thrones scripts years ago. Which is there's an intersection between pop culture and, you know, international intrigue. I love it.
Well, Adam, I guess you got to learn your trade somewhere. And it looks like this particular Iranian guy, Behad Mezri, was one of those attempting to blackmail HBO over their script. You know, whether that's training, whether that's fundraising, you know, for the, you know, the Iranian government or, you know, private sector, you know, we don't really know, but, you know, clearly this guy had a history before he was doing what he was doing for the government.
Yeah. So look, there's plenty to read about on that one. I've linked through to a few pieces in this week's show notes. But look, the TLDR is this woman had already been out for a while. She'd converted to Islam. She had, you know, I mean, she'd said that she'd seen some stuff that really turned her off US policy. And I'm sure many people who served where she served did. She was in Afghanistan for a bit and other times at Qatar. And then, yeah, decided to flip and wanted to move to Iran. Oh, there's some great details in the indictment as well about how at one point, like her handlers, her Iranian handlers weren't like taking her seriously. So she threatened to like just get herself to some remote place and then start dropping stuff on WikiLeaks. And I think she said, I'll just do like what Snowden did. And then I think they booked her a cab to the airport like that day. So yeah, just a really crazy story. I'm curious why they've indicted now, but I guess that's the climate we're in, right? Where intelligence agencies seem, and the Department of Justice in the US seems to be favoring action over stealth. So yeah, interesting anyway. Now look, turning our attention to Australia, last week, we spoke about this attack against Australia's Parliament House, but it turns out that by the looks of things, it's not just been Australian Parliament House that's been affected, but also our political parties. I want to play now a clip from our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, this week's Australian Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, talking a little bit about what's been happening. Here he is.
Members will be aware that the Australian Cyber Security Centre recently identified a malicious intrusion into the Australian Parliament House computer network. During the course of this work, we also became aware that the networks of some political parties, Liberal, Labor and Nationals, have also been affected. Our security agencies have detected this activity and acted decisively to confront it. They are securing these systems and protecting users. Now, I do not propose to go into the detail of these operational matters, but our cyber experts believe that a sophisticated state actor is responsible for this malicious activity. Let me be clear, though, there is no evidence of any electoral interference. We have put in place a number of measures to ensure the integrity, though, of our electoral system. I have instructed the Australian Cybersecurity Centre to be ready to provide any political party or electoral body in Australia with immediate support, including making their technical experts available. They have already briefed the electoral commissions and those responsible for cybersecurity for all states and territories. They have also worked with global antivirus companies to ensure Australia's friends and allies have the capacity to detect this malicious activity. We have acted decisively to protect our national interests. The methods used by malicious actors are constantly evolving, and this incident just reinforces yet again the importance of cybersecurity as a fundamental part of everyone's business. The government has chosen to be transparent about these matters. This is in itself an expression of faith by our government in our democratic system and our determination to defend it.
So there you go, Australia's Prime Minister of the Month, Scott Morrison, managing to actually sound prime ministerial for the first time in his admittedly very, very short tenure. But what do we make of this, Adam? Because this, you know, I mean, okay, an attack against Parliament, the Parliament House network is one thing, but geez, you know, when you've got all of the major parties, you know, shells popping out at all the major parties, that's a pretty big deal, I think.
Yeah, and certainly the fact that it's, you know, it's one actor, it's one campaign, that's a pretty kind of clear message of intent there. And I imagine there is quite a lot of, you know, of hand-wringing in Australia about this. I mean, it's no one's come out and said, I mean, none of the Australian government have come out and said it's China, but that seems to be the, you know, the scuttlebutt. It's China is what everyone's saying.
It's the vibe, yeah. There's a China vibe.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, you know, given the sort of political back and forth, between China and the West and, you know, Australia in particular, you know, that's pretty kind of clear message. I mean, whether or not the Chinese specifically, you know, meant to get caught, got caught to make a point, whether they got caught because they, you know, the defensive capabilities in Australia was not bad. You know, we don't know that part of it yet. Maybe that will become clear eventually.
So what I can tell you is that, you know, I do have one source in the Australian Parliament House who said that the attack was actually caught on the APH side. It was actually caught you know, reasonably well, right? Like they did a pretty good job there. I'm guessing it was some sort of lateral movement thing and they got it, they caught it at that phase and went, oh, okay, crap. We've seen some elevated privileges here. That's not right. You know, called ASD in. I'm guessing from there what happened is ACSC, the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, actually, you know, generated some IOCs and then passed them out to stakeholders. The thing that's impressed me about this is that we actually know that Australia's political parties were affected by this. I mean, what that tells me is that IOCs from the APH attack actually wound up with the political parties and they were able to use them. I mean, how good is that? This is a good news story.
Oh, God, it is, isn't it? That's terrifying.
But it is. It is. Like, how many countries would actually think to actually, you know, pass those IOCs along to the political parties? And, you know, I mean, I'm impressed. I'm actually a little bit impressed that they've been able to unravel this campaign, even though we've got a mix of, like, non-government and government systems here.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, that is actually a very good point, that this was, you know, they were able to leverage this intelligence that they found and then, you know, find a bunch more stuff. And, of course, the question I have is, well, what about us over in New Zealand? Because, I mean, you know, we're kind of a target too. And we haven't seen anyone saying all of our parties are owned, our parliaments are owned. And they've got to be. Like, it would be ridiculous for them not to be. So,
but you've only got like 20 computers in the whole country, right?
Something like that, yes. Which you'd think then would be straightforward to run, you know, run some of those ISVs past. But I don't know.
Now, look, the politics of this are just really crazy, right? Because Australia, you know, China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Last year, we even passed anti-Chinese influence legislation, right? So the extent of Chinese influence in Australian politics has really grown. There are now political efforts to combat that, and the relationship is very, very weird. Now, this is why we haven't seen Australia name China. Like, every journalist in Australia says they've got sources who say, yeah, it's China. But we have not heard the C word uttered from any politician's lips. Now, meanwhile, there's a bit of an interesting situation developing in China itself relating to Australian trade.
Yes, apparently Chinese orders of Australian coal have been frozen because the Chinese customs agencies are taking ages to clear the shipments through, and of course the Chinese buyers still need some coal and they've been buying it elsewhere, such as Indonesia. And, you know, Australia is the biggest exporter of coal and China is the biggest importer. Apparently orders are tailing off, coal prices in Australia is tanking.
Yeah, so, I mean, they've doubled their customs clearance times to 40 days. Now, I don't know if this is a message because they're unhappy about some of the rhetoric that's been emerging from Australia. But look, I'm just trying to give some context here that there's a reason the government hasn't named a country here. And I suspect that's it. I'm going to guess that this will be an evolving story. So let's just see where it takes us. Now, Brian Krebs has done a bit of a deep dive on the Iranian DNS attacks, which is, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the interesting things about it is it shows us just how far back some of this activity goes.
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting follow-up to some of the reporting that we've seen previously about these attacks. And I learned actually a bunch of things from this write-up. You know, obviously, there's some of the historical aspects. Brian went through some of the IP addresses that were released by, you know, CrowdStrike and various other Cisco Talos who've been doing the investigations. Plumbed that through things like DNSDB, the passive DNS database, to figure out what other things would be going on, put some timelines around things. So that was, you know, gave some interesting insights into some of the targets and when this was happening, you know, going back into beginning of 2017, for example. The other thing that's really interesting is there is a, you know, when we reported on this previously, it's kind of sounded like the Iranians had been owning registrar accounts for the domains and modifying, you know, the name servers and hijacking it like that. There's a bunch of extra detail in here about them actually breaking into some of the, you know, more serious parts of the DNS infrastructure, you know, one of the root DNS operators, for example, Netnod in Sweden, and also into some of the systems of Packet Clearinghouse, which is, you know, another kind of key player in the DNS space. And that's a much more interesting angle than just, you know, credential stuffing into registrar accounts.
It is.
Hijacking stuff with DNSSEC involved, which is, yeah, it's pretty sophisticated.
But in many cases, they actually forgot to bypass DNSSEC, even though they could have turned it off.
So, yeah, in the case of Packet Clearinghouse, yes, they attempted to hijack mail from Packet Clearinghouse and did so without turning DNSSEC off, which then caused, you know, the vast bulk of Packet Clearinghouse's clients that used a recursive resolver that actually validated DNSSEC, which is amazing in itself. They only a couple of the clients were using other resolvers and got owned as a result. Whereas in NetNod's case, they did actually unglue the DNSSEC glue in the parent zone to bypass the existence of DNSSEC, which is pretty smart, to be honest.
So what we're saying is DNSSEC had an accidental win. So there you go, because someone forgot to turn it off. Now, interestingly enough, I saw someone, forgive me, I can't remember who it was, who were posting around a link to a Reuters article from 2018, December 2018, talking about Albania expelling Iranian diplomats on national security grounds. And then we look at the Krebs write-up and we see that apparently the Albanian State Intelligence Service was one of the victims of this DNS campaign. So that might, you know, this Twitter user, again, can't remember who it was, connected those dots. I think that's pretty interesting. But look, it really feels like, you know, 2016 felt like it was going to be peak cyber, but this year already, I'm starting to get the feeling that we're going to see, you know, this is going to be a pretty crazy year. Now, Clon Kitchen is a formerly intelligence community guy who then worked for Senator Ben Sasse as his sort of national security advisor, I believe, now works at an ultra-conservative think tank called the Heritage Foundation. And, you know, he says we're seeing a lot of preparation right now from state actors and things could get crazy this year. Here's what he told me.
The operational preparation and environment that we're seeing suggests we could cross some new lines this year that were unimaginable even 6 months ago. The U.S. Director of National Intelligence just testified that Moscow is now staging cyber attack assets on civilian military infrastructure, and that China has even established the ability to disrupt U.S. critical infrastructure right now, like natural gas lines. You know, and this is just what we're saying publicly. You place these activities into the broader geopolitical context where U.S. cyber efforts are going to be rightly more aggressive, where Beijing and Moscow are feeling significant economic and political pressure and are going to want to reassert themselves, and where the sheer number of cyber actors continues to grow. And we've got everything you would need for a significant upturn in op tempo and red line busting. I remember last year when the Director of National Intelligence said that the warning lights for our national cybersecurity are blinking red. Well, you know, his testimony and these trends make it clear that those lights are still flashing and may soon start flashing even faster.
Yeah, Clon Kitchen there from the Heritage Foundation, which, you know, I understand that think tank is very influential in the Trump administration. But what do you think, Adam? Do you think we're going to see a lot of red lines crossed this year?
It certainly does kind of look that way. I mean, the intersection of cyber and politics and international relations has absolutely been, you know, on an upwards trend, you know, from Stuxnet onwards. But it really does feel like, you know, the operational capabilities of a bunch of these countries, you know, has got to the point where it's genuinely useful for them and they have, you know, real political goals to accomplish. And, you know, we expect to see them using it. I think they are using them.
Yeah. Well, everywhere we see a political crisis, we do see tend to see activity, and Venezuela is in the news a lot at the moment, and we're seeing some interesting stuff happening there.
Yeah, the Venezuelan government appears to be using its national ISP to just straight up fish people. There's a bunch of campaigns to try and, you know, there's a lot of turmoil domestically in Venezuela at the moment. There's some campaigns, for example, to try and help get international aid into the country, and people are self-organizing. And yeah, the government has been, you know, just using their DNS control in the state ISPs to just hijack people's connections to those, you know, present fake phishing sites for, you know, things like Gmail and Facebook and Microsoft services to try and, you know, figure out who's organizing and presumably go ahead and, you know, cause them some grief.
Yeah, so that's one to keep an eye on. And that seems to be escalating because I don't know if you remember, a couple of weeks ago we heard from a guy who'd been doing some research on the blocking activity that the Venezuelan government had been doing. And they weren't doing it very comprehensively, but they were doing sort of opportunistic SNI-based filtering when Juan Guaido was speaking, things like that. So we're just going to keep an eye on that. Now, look, we got two stories this week about data leaks, I guess you'd call them. And one of them comes out of China. And this is just, what makes this interesting is it gives us a little bit of insight into the surveillance capability of the Chinese state. And it's mind-boggling horror show dystopian stuff.
Yeah, it really is. This story is about a set of like facial recognition data that was being collected by the Chinese government to monitor the movement of Muslim Uyghurs in China. And yeah, they left that just lying around the internet. And a bunch of people found something like data from 2.5 million people being tracked through face recognition, just, you know, sitting there on the internet, which Mean, would be terrible.
And when we say tracked, we mean that, like, when these people whose faces are in this system are just out walking down the street minding their own business, like, they're being scanned by, you know, facial recognition software from camera feeds, and their locations and times logged. That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, and this kind of, you know, I mean, this kind of data leak would be terrible, whatever, you know, whatever it was being used for. But the fact that it's also been used for this is just, yeah, I mean, it's unimaginable. Well, it would have been, I guess, unimaginable. Now it's the dystopian future we live in.
It's absolutely abhorrent what's happening over there. Now, switching over to one that, like, look, if it wasn't such a serious privacy violation, you'd almost laugh at it. But, you know, millions of calls to a Swedish healthcare hotline were apparently just, you know, stored on a NAS that someone left on the internet without auth. And the media got a hold of that, and obviously it's been rectified now. No word yet on how many of the calls may have been accessed. I think, you know, I saw some talk that maybe a handful were accessed, but it looks like maybe just, you know, by nature of being audio files, people did not access that. But holy moly, you're going to imagine there's some pretty personal stuff in that content.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Any system that records call center stuff is, you know, bad enough, and we've seen enough of those on the internet. But when it's specifically health information, like, that's just straight up rude. And, you know, having no logs, I mean, I can't imagine there's a whole bunch of logs in the system that was exposing this data, which goes back to, like, 2013, something like 170,000 hours of call recordings. I mean, that's just,
like, why do you need ludicrous. That? Why do you need
well,
that?
Well, you know, for training purposes, whatever they say.
When yeah, for training and quality center. Assurance purposes. Yeah. Right. A Maltese bank called Bank of Valletta, apparently they caught 13 million euros in dodgy transfers when they were doing, you know, end of the day reconciliation operations. And they had to shut down the bank, the ATM network, all sorts of stuff. It caused all sorts of grief in Malta. But they were able to, by the looks of things, roll back those transactions. No word yet on who the culprit is.
Yeah, we haven't seen any attribution. Of course, there's, you know, plenty of people who've been stealing money from banks in the past that we might point to, you know, cough North Korea. But yeah, I mean, this is a big bank. Like, it's one of the larger banks in Malta, like, processes transactions for the government of Malta. So this is a pretty big deal. And I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like being in the meeting where they made the call to just, you know, turn off all the computers in the bank whilst they figure out what's going on. So yeah, that's a pretty big deal.
CrowdStrike, meanwhile, has put out a big report about APT activity. The interesting thing here is they use this metric, right, to, like, rank APT countries or APT, you know, countries that have APT crews, you know, working for them. They've ranked them by speed to lateral movement, right, which I thought was a pretty interesting metric. Maybe not, you know, maybe it's not an incredibly comprehensive metric, but at least it's an interesting one. What did you think of this?
I mean, I think that actually this is really, really interesting. I mean, you know, everyone says, oh, you know, sophisticated attackers are in our business, like in the Australian Parliament. But what does sophisticated mean, right? And we've seen, obviously, very unsophisticated campaigns work very well, like the one we talked about with Iran and bad phishing. So a different metric other than it's sophisticated or persistent or advanced, I think, is useful. So I quite like speed because it is really important as an attacker to keep moving, not get bogged down. And, you know, to a certain extent, it doesn't matter how good the defensive capabilities are if you can move faster than them. So yeah, I like it as a metric, and I'm glad to see them, you know, kind of talking about it.
So Dmitry Alperovich, of course, is the head honcho over there at CrowdStrike, and he got in touch to actually send me this report under embargo last week. And I thought I'd, you know, ask him a different sort of question, and I'd ask him to critique the metric that they're pushing, right? And to his credit, he did. And you're going to hear a few minutes of Dmitry here, but it's interesting stuff. Here's what he said.
It's not perfect, and, you know, there are a couple of limitations with what we've done here that we recognize. One is that we averaged out all the results, and there's a lot of internal debate about whether to do it or not. It makes things simpler for people to consume, to just look at one number for Russia, one number for North Korea, China, and so forth. But, of course, it hides the fact that there are better groups and worse groups in each country. The hope is that kind of it evens out, because in every country you have different degrees of sophistication. And if you kind of average it all together, hopefully you get a pretty representative view of how overall the military and intelligence services are doing. The weakest point here is probably criminal groups, because there you do see just huge amount of variety and you have some criminal groups that are exceptionally fast, as good as many of the nation states, and then a ton of criminal groups that are much slower and drag the overall average down. So that's probably the most concerning part about averaging this. You know, the other point, of course, is that we make an assumption that everyone wants to be fast, and that may not be a valid assumption. Some people may not care about being fast, although I do think that as defensive technologies are getting better and better, getting fast is important because you actually are able to accomplish your objective before someone picks up and detects your movements and throws you out. But, you know, the one thing that someone mentioned to me earlier that this might capture is actually not as much about how fast they are, but really the way they're structured internally. So if they're slower, maybe it doesn't mean that they're worse, but it means that they do handoffs to other teams that pick up things much later in the process, and that's why the numbers come out to be a lot longer than they might be if it's the same team that actually is doing the intrusion. The other thing, of course, to point out is that this is based on our data, our customers, our visibility. We do have a pretty representative cross-section of every major industry, companies, government agencies, deployments in over 176 countries, but it's not universal. So it's possible that someone looking at other data sets may come up with different measurements. It is what it is, and we base it on the data we've got. And we only rank adversaries for which we have live intrusion data and also that are attributed. So not every adversary is represented. And we hope that in the future, as we get more and more intrusion cases on other types of adversaries, we can include them in this as well. But right now, we've got the four major nation state actors that we see most often, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and all the criminal groups that we aggregate as well.
I thought that was actually a pretty, pretty thoughtful response to the question.
Yeah, agreed. It's, good to see them really kind of thinking clearly about what they're doing there. I agree with his, the caveats, I guess, he puts around the utility of that information.
We've got a Sammy is my hero situation in Russia. For those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, I'm talking about Sammy Kamkar's, legendary MySpace worm. Sammy is my hero. Something similar popping up on Russian social networks.
Yeah, apparently someone had reported a bug to VKontakte, the Russian social network, that they then hadn't got around to fixing. And so for Valentine's Day this year, they turned that into a worm, and people were, anyone who visited the relevant page would then repost the link to the story about this particular thing. And then that just kind of went snowball on it. It does appear that VKontakte kind of took it on the chin.
They did. They did. I was impressed.
Yeah, which wasn't really where I thought that story was going to go.
No.
I thought it was going to end with people being locked up. But no, apparently they went, okay, fair cop, and are going to fix the bug. And no one appears to be getting thrown in the gulag for it.
Man, I saw Sammy speak at OSSET a couple of years back, and it was funny him talking about that experience of when he unleashed this thing and he just watched MySpace getting slower and slower and then disappear. And then he's like hiding in the corner of his room, something along those lines, And then he was just, he filled with a sense of dread anyway. That was pretty funny. Now, look, you and I, we've spoken about this court action a couple of times. This is authorities in the United States wanted to get Facebook to crack open Facebook voice calls because they were investigating this MS-13 gang. And in the end, the court decided that Facebook did not have to do that. But what's interesting here is we're not going to find out what the FBI actually had in mind. We're not going to find out the details of how they wanted Facebook to implement this this interception for them, which I think is kind of interesting, right?
Yeah, the judge in this case ruled that disclosing a bunch of information about the specifics of what the government were asking for would, expose the techniques and methodologies that the FBI were, that use in general and were specifically trying to use in this case, and that would, kind of help people on the other side a little too much. So, yeah, we don't get to see what they were asking for.
Yeah, that was an action by the ACLU supported by the Washington Post and Facebook. That's a fresh decision. The decision actually saying that they didn't have to do it, that was a little bit old. But yeah, we just don't get to see. That's the new thing. Now, the Government Accountability Office has released a report And they're saying that Congress in the United States should introduce something like an American GDPR. This is going to be an interesting battle, I think. If there's any movement on this, I mean, you can imagine the lobbying. You can imagine the lobbying.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that it's probably necessary. I mean, the reporting we've had over the last few weeks with the mobile phone carriers, giving out everyone's information about location, clearly there is need for a more controlled privacy situation in the US. You know, I think a European style one is going to result in a lot of lobbying and a lot of wrangling and a lot of, wringing of hands at the various companies that make money out of advertising and data aggregation. But I mean, they're going to have to come up with something because the current situation is not going to work out, despite there being such a, that despite advertising being such an kind of important part of the US digital economy, that, they're going to have to suck up some restrictions on what they can do.
Yeah, I have a feeling we're going to wind up with something like GDPR Lite. I can't see them going full GDPR. Let's put it that way.
No, never go full GDPR.
GDPR, yes, of course. Marcus Hutchins, otherwise known as Malware Tech, has lost his bid to suppress the statements he made when he was initially arrested in the United States for allegedly writing code that wound up in the Kronos Trojan. He seemed to be arguing that he was a little bit under the weather from days of partying in Vegas and didn't understand his rights and yada yada yada. But the court said, "Well, no," basically. So not good for him.
Yeah, this is probably not going to help his case because it sounds like he really didn't. He kind of cooperated with the people who were questioning him when he was picked up at the airport in Vegas, and presumably said a bunch of things that were incriminating. Having been to Vegas only a couple of times now, but I can kind of understand after a week in Vegas, like you really don't feel particularly smart. And the court argued that clearly he's a smart guy, therefore he should understand what was going on. But like anyone who's been to the hacker cons in Vegas, you do understand that feel. Of being a little bit vague after, even if you're not drunk or whatever, just spending time in Vegas is enough to make you feel stupid.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, he did say stuff like, "What? Black hat stuff? I haven't done that in years." And, things along those lines. And that's not what you want to be telling the cops, guy. I think he was, it seems from reading this stuff that he thought it was maybe a friendly chat and didn't necessarily realize this was about stuff that he may have allegedly done when he was a teenager. He thought they were just asking him for, information on things that other people may have done. But yes, that was not the case. And he's still in America, which sucks. I really hope that gets resolved soon. I did an interview on this, I think, sometime last year about the possibility of hiding malware in SGX enclaves. Someone's done it now. No real surprises there. What I find interesting about this is that Intel's response is like, "Well, yeah, don't run code from untrusted sources." Seems to be kind of missing the point. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I understand what they're saying. I mean, obviously, whenever you design a security control, there's a set of threats that it's specifically to do, and there's a bunch of stuff that's outside of the scope, outside of the brief. And they're saying, "Hey, this is outside of the threat model of what SGX is meant to do, deal with it," which, I feel sorry for the engineer that, the manager came up and said, "Hey, can you help us write the response for PR for this particular thing?" And they went, "Well, threat model says, yeah, not our problem." But that's kind of not good enough. And in this particular case, the research, one of the things with SGX that Intel argues is that there is a process for signing code that's going to get run in that environment. And you have to have, the relevant key material to sign things.
Hey, it worked well for the Iranians, right?
Exactly, right. And that's where they've just gone, not our problem, somebody else's problem. And of course, the researchers have just gone to Intel and bought signed up for a certificate and written their code. There are a couple of other controls that this research got passed around what you can do when you're running inside the enclave. And in this case, they use some quite, kind of clever, return-oriented programming style things to execute code that, otherwise wouldn't have been allowed in the SGX, which, that seems like smart work. But yeah, overall, the real problem is that, Intel's threat model doesn't match up with what we want it to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, I should point out here to those who aren't familiar with Intel's SGX and what it does that, in essence, this means that you can create malware that is invisible.
Yeah, I mean, it provides a secure enclave for things that are meant to be running, outside of the context of the main operating system. In this case, I guess the point is beyond the reach of, security controls and antivirus and things that are running in the general host OS. And it would then let you do all sorts of fun and interesting things from a position of safety.
Yeah, I'm just curious to see where this type of, this branch of research goes, to be honest, because I think we could get into a pretty ugly place. Yeah. Anyway, Google Play Store, apparently their app rejections are up 55% from last year, and they're suspending 66% more apps than they were last year. Not terribly surprised by this.
No, I mean, obviously they've been improving their automated code reviewing technology. I think the thing that's more interesting here is that they've also been looking for patterns around the developer accounts. So they give an example of, you know, when you ban someone's account for uploading dodgy apps, they're just going to go make a new account. And they've been working on tech to try and spot that style of you know, re-sign up to then be able to more quickly identify malicious users even when they change their account information. And that seems smart.
Yeah, Dan Gooden at Ars has written up a like a demo of a Facebook fish, like a Facebook SSO fish that looks really convincing because they like render a fake URL bar with a, you know, certificate that looks like it's all encrypted and everything. And, you know, you sort of read a story like that and you go, yeah, whatever. Then you watch the video and you're like, oh, God, that's actually pretty convincing. Did you have the same reaction as me on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, it's dumb, but it's going to work, and that makes it not dumb. You know, writing some code that, you know, figures out the user agent of the browser that's coming in and then generating fake window Chrome to make it look like, you know, a native platform window has been spawned with your single sign-on. I mean, that's a thing that we've used in many different guises over the years, but it works. I mean, it looks flawless until
that's
you try
the thing,
to, you know,
that's
drag
the thing that got me about this one. It looked absolutely perfect.
Yep. Well, I mean, and that's, you know, that's what it needs to be to work. And, you know, clearly it's gonna, and this, I mean, it's not just Facebook. I mean, this example is Facebook, obviously, but anything that where users are expecting to from one site get a single sign on pop up for another, you know, identity validation, Microsoft's, you know, ADFS or, Google single sign on or something, like, it's gonna work in much the same way. And yeah, I think we'll see people using this technique because it, you know, it just works.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a video, I've linked to a video there. It's like a minute long. Check it out because it's like, yeah, you think, oh, I don't fall for those sort of pop-ups. And you, then you see this one, you're like, oh, God, that one's pretty good. Google was for a time planning to modify Chrome and, you know, these modifications would have crippled ad blockers. They have now backed away from those changes.
Yeah, this is where they were going to restrict access to the more kind of full-featured Web Intercept API for plugins to use, for extensions to use. They were claiming that it was extensions were in general too slow to handle every web request going through the browser. Apparently, after some research by some of the ad blocking community, turns out that's not the case. Most of the ad blockers are pretty snappy if you pick a good one. And yeah, Google has kind of backtracked and agreed that they're not going to remove that API from the set that extensions can use.
Now, look, this next one comes to us via Joseph Cox at Motherboard. And, you know, the headline reads, scammers are filing fake trademarks to steal high-value Instagram accounts. Now, the reason I mention this one is because back in 2015, I got approached by a business, you know, through mutual friends. I live in a small town. This sort of fashion and furniture business got in touch with me, and their Instagram account, they said, had been hacked, right? So they were at their wit's end because they used Instagram to heavily promote their new lines, things like that. Like it was a big deal for them, right? It was costing them money. So by the time I get there, it's been a couple of weeks and they're pulling their hair out. And then I actually figured out what had happened. And it was this. It was that someone had registered an Instagram handle that was very similar to theirs. Then they lodged a trademark application for this business's name. And even though the trademark application hadn't even been approved yet, they were able to dodgy the paperwork, send it off to Instagram, and seize the handle that they wanted, which happened to belong to this business. Now, they didn't get full access to the account. They didn't get to keep the followers. But of course, people started refollowing this account. They sort of built it up that way. And this was, the person who'd stolen this account was actually based in Melbourne, you know, also in Australia, and was using it to sell crappy jewelry, basically. Now, I tried to help them out here. I got in touch with a few people I knew at the company, and it wasn't progressing. We even got an email back from them saying, we've reviewed your case and there's nothing we can do. We're very sorry. You violated a trademark. So this is a thing that's been around for a long time and it's something they're aware of. And I was really surprised to see it pop up in the news. In the end, I made a call to someone quite senior and they sorted it out in about 10 minutes. But I don't like doing that. I don't like being, you know, using journo contacts to do that sort of thing. But in the end, I did because I just felt really sorry for these people. But I am surprised to see this happening now.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those techniques that, you know, is kind of obvious when you see it explained, and the fact that it works means that people are going to do it. I mean, there's plenty of other, I mean, trademarks are one avenue. There's sort of other avenues that one could go down, you know, when you're trying to use the fact that you have some official status outside of the internet world that you can then leverage for whatever reason. And yeah, we're seeing people, you know, kind of reselling the service of, oh, I'll register a trademark for you in, you know, in Britain or in France or wherever, you know, for a fee on Bitcoin for, you know, on forums for Bitcoin, which, yeah, I mean, suggests that this is, you know, a growing kind of part of the tool set that people have got, you know, for identity theft, either at an individual or at a, you know, organizational level.
Yeah, you'd just think, though, I mean, that was about 3 and a bit years ago. You would have thought they'd invested a bit of time into improving those processes, and they haven't. So that's quite unfortunate. Chrome, now, look, I probably should have put this story with the other Chrome story, but apparently Google's working on a new Chrome security feature that actually looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, this is a control they're proposing to add to kind of limit the effectiveness of DOM-based cross-site scripting, which is where you've got kind of cross-site scripting within the browser itself. So it's sort of like, you know, second order of cross. Anyway, it's cross-site scripting. One of the ways you can do cross-site scripting, Google's proposing a control that would kind of extend the existing content security policy headers to allow a site to, you know, specify where it expects to be able to inject content in a way that's then not going to get DOM accessed if it's abused by an attacker. So interesting control. One of the sort of really technical parts of browser security stuff that, you know, I expect that people will need to keep track of, but just one of many, unfortunately.
Yeah, but it just means that website operators can actually use that, right? So one less thing to worry about. So yay.
Yeah, definitely. Although it's just, you know, configuring this stuff right is really complicated. Yeah. And I feel sorry for website owners, you know, having to understand this much detail about the web security model, which really is too complicated to make sense.
Microsoft has fixed up a zero-day in IE and also in Exchange. So that's nice.
Yeah, this is the Exchange bug we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which, yeah, really, really, you want to, you know, work this patch in your environment if you run Exchange. And of course, yeah, anytime there's an IE O-Day, you're going to want to deal with that too, all of the corporate listeners.
Well, mate, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks a lot for that. And I think by the looks of things, we're actually going to be doing the news IRL next week in New Zealand.
Yeah, Pat, you're flying back through Auckland, and I think we're going to get together. We'll do the news in the same room for a change, and yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
I'm really looking forward to it, mate, so I'll see you next week.
Yeah, we'll literally see you next week, too. That'll be lots of fun. See you then.
That was Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to him for that. Now, before we moved on, I recently learned of an interesting paid incubator program that I wanted to mention, and this is not a paid announcement. The Aspen Tech Policy Hub is a paid incubator program training technologists on how to engage in policy, and it's currently open for applications. Aspen models itself after tech incubators like Y Combinator. They take tech experts, teach them the policy process through an in-residence fellowship program in the Bay Area, and encourage them to develop outside-the-box solutions to society's problems. The fellowship program will be held from June to August in the San Francisco Bay Area, and successful applicants will be paid $7,500 a month for their participation. Applications are due on February 27, and VCs, founders, engineers, and other tech experts are encouraged to apply. I've dropped a link through to them in this week's show notes. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by BugCrowd, the company that allows you to outsource your bug bounties to its crowd and triage them. But you know what? That is not all they're doing now. BugCrowd is making a play for the web app penetration testing market. Late last year, they launched what they're calling next generation pen tests, because this is the security industry and everything that's new is next generation, in case you didn't get the memo. But yeah, the idea here is actually pretty novel. They're offering these blended assessments where there's a pen tester involved and a bounty pool that selected participants from BugCrowd's talent pool can compete for. The idea is it's the best of both worlds. And where this gets very interesting is BugCrowd now say that these next-gen pen tests will tick all the compliance boxes they need to for testing under PCI, NIST, and ISO standards. BugCrowd's Jason Haddix joined me to talk about BugCrowd's next-gen pen tests, and he started off by telling me that they've been a bigger hit with customers than they'd expected. Here he is.
So we set a goal for running just a few in December, right? Like, we wanted to have a successful launch of the product, make sure the technology backing it and the methodology that the pen test researchers were adhering to was solid. So we set a metric of running probably like, I would say 10 or something like that. And we've far outsold that. In just the month of December, that was our goal. We've far outsold that by like 3x, 4x already. So I don't have the exact numbers in front of me right now, but we're heading well into 2019, just in the first couple months, scheduling a lot of NGPT tests and getting a lot of researchers lined up to do the work.
So that sounds like one of those pleasant surprise type of deals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you launch a new product, there's always a beta period, and then there's also a grace period when you first launch it. And, you know, we gave ourselves realistic metrics to see how this thing would go. There was a lot of response to you know, the hybrid methodology, right? Like having the crowd run it as well as independent researchers running on top of it who are pen testers and doing a little bit of a different methodology, right? The crowd does their thing, right? Each crowd member has their own methodology, their own things they look for there, and they're not really touching on, you know, a breadth of any one given thing. They just do what they're good at. Like, you know, I, for instance, am, you know, good at recon. So I find sites that that people forget about, and, you know, usually those are less security standard assessed sites. And so by far, we don't want to get rid of any of that, but we did want to add professional pen testers who have methodologies that go through things like NIST and the Web Application Hackers Handbook methodology, and things like the OWASP testing guide methodology, and have them go through from A to Z and test everything in that methodology. So we now have two concurrent sets of researchers that start at the same time. The NGPT researchers start out of the gate adhering to the methodology, and they're paid up front, right? It's not pay for results anymore. It's pay for effort, and they get paid no matter what. And so they're in this separate crowd, and then they adhere to the methodology. We have a pretty strict templated methodology that you need to adhere to, and then the bug hunters test.
Okay, and then the bug hunters do bug hunty stuff, right? And they're up for a part of a bounty pool, right? I've got that. So what it sounds like you're doing is you're really, you know, you've got two components to this. You are actually attaching professional pen testers to each of these exercises. How are you then recruiting these pen testers and vetting these pen testers for that component of what you're calling a next generation pen test?
We've actually been doing it a lot by our existing crowd, right? So it's actually like a giant crossover. So people tend to think that the bug crowd researchers are somehow different. I would say, you know, if I had to pull it roughly out of the air, I would say 80% of them, 90% of them are already in some fashion doing pen testing, either individual contracts or entities that they run themselves, or they work for a consulting company. So We just had to go out to the crowd and pull the data of who was doing this. And we already had that data, but we weren't applying it to anything. Now we've basically taken everybody from our elite private crowd that we use for bounties, and we've talked to them about, you know, skills verification and their tenure in pen testing. And we've started to invite them just by referral and by themselves, by their sales data that they have on the platform into the NGPT program. And that's our first small cadre of people that are coming into the next generation pen test crowd.
And how are you working out how much to pay the pen test people, you know, the people on the pen test side of things?
That's a good question. So we're setting a standard of prepay that's a little bit higher than our competitors. I'm not authorized to release the numbers yet because it varies by client and project, right? So if you have a hard target, you know, obviously what we call it is the researcher grant or the NGPT grant at the front end of the project is going to be larger. So if it's like a thick client, a hard network target, a binary of some sort, those skills are harder to find and harder to instrument for these programs. So the researcher grant it's much higher. For web targets, it's still a higher standard than some of the other kind of things that we're doing here, but it can be in the range of anywhere from 1.5K to, you know, up to like 10K, depending on, you know, the target that we're up against.
No, it makes sense. Now, look, another thing that is very interesting here is that you've commissioned a third-party audit that you say allows you to assert that these exercises are enough to achieve compliance, you know, cross-off compliance for PCI, NIST, and ISO standards. who conducted this audit? I mean, that is a bold claim to say that these exercises will allow you to tick off, you know, compliance, the testing component of compliance to some of these, you know, standards. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that that I specifically and then some of the other architects of the NGPT program wanted to make sure was that this wasn't just lip service, that we made sure that we ticked off all the compliance check boxes that everybody needs, you know, to get a service for a pen test, right? So we independently created this methodology called the Bug Hunters methodology, and it takes the best out of all of the operational-based hacking methodologies, security assessment methodologies that most of the standards really want you to adhere to. And when you dig down deep, there's tons of different types of standards out there, like OSTMM and PCI, and there's two types of standards. There's one that gives you the operational flow for a pen test, which is like recon and then discovery, exploitability feeds back into recon. Like they have these four tiers and those don't really tell anybody what you want in the test. They don't really satisfy auditors. So we took the ones that were not workflow and we took all the ones that were operational and kind of combined them into what we thought was a very powerful methodology that the pen testers on NGPT need to follow. So these were things like the Web Application Hackers Handbook methodology, things like specific guidance in PCI, everything that was specific about testing technologies in NIST, and then everything else that we could find from the platform data that we have. And we took all that and mashed it into methodology. And then we sent it to a group called Shellman and Company. And they're an independent auditor who assesses services like pen test companies and says, does this service map to PCI 11.3, NIST 800-53-REV-4, ISO 27001A12-61? And so we sent the methodology over to them and guided them through the process of what this looks like. And we came back with a great score on that. This fulfills all of those requirements. We knew that our clients would want something like this. The idea here is a little bit new, the hybrid methodology. And really our reports are the proof in the pudding, right? They have the best of both worlds, both breadth of coverage and depth of coverage, highly technical findings, proof that coverage was mapped through our VPN product, traffic control. We've got it all, and we were very happy with the results of this independent assessment.
One thing that I always say to pen testers I know who look at programs like these and say, oh, they're rubbish, they're terrible, you know, who you never know who you're getting. I always say to them now, you know, imagine that your job is actually performing these sorts of activities through this platform. Can you see the value in it then, if it's you doing the work? And then miraculously, they always see the value, which I find kind of funny. I mean, I'm guessing the idea here is to really build out the pool of people who can do this. Now, look, we don't have that much time left, so there's a couple other things I wanted to talk about. One of them is that to verify that the methodology has been adhered to, you've built what you're calling a traffic control VPN, which does allow you to do some verification that the methodologies you've asked people to deliver have been delivered. How automatic is that versus manual analysis? Is that a difficult thing to sort of, a time-consuming thing to sort of verify?
With the VPN product, it's not difficult at all, right? Like what we're looking for here is data attack traffic of certain, you know, categories reach certain endpoints, parameters, were testing workflows adhered to. We can ask those questions via the platform, and then the verification can come through the traffic monitoring. So it was an exercise for us to build that into, you know, parsing the logs. But when you get the report output for an NGPT, it gives you a broad overview of the whole test, right? How many endpoints were seen, how many domains were seen if it's a multi-domain project, how many URLs were tested, how many of those were vulnerable to certain categories of vulnerability. And then it also dumps everything that we saw, everything that our testers saw in a conglomeration, right? I mean, every researcher is on the VPN, so it mashes all those results together. And it gives you a coverage map of where they were and where the vulnerabilities were in the application. So you get a really good feel for, what was tested. And, if you were to want to reprioritize, or if you just wanted to tell your development staff, hey, this is where we have the most issues, it's very apparent in seeing the output of the NGPT report of where some of the vulnerabilities were.
Now, last thing I wanted to ask you about is you're launching a CTF program, and this strikes me as a somewhat odd move. I mean, the idea behind this CTF program is to be able to, you know, spot talent. I'd imagine this is a very useful sort of recruitment tool for the crowd. But don't you already have, you know, indications through people's existing activity on the platform, like who's good at what? I just would have thought this would be doubling up.
It is doubling up. That's that could be a correct term, right? So, we do have data about who's on our platform kicking butt, and that's something we want to continue to leverage. It goes into an initiative called crowd graphing for us, where we take trust and technology information and vulnerability information every researcher has done. But we're looking in 2019 to extend it, right? If I were to flip the question on you and ask you, you know, what do you look for in a security professional, and when you hire them outside of Bug Crowd, there are a whole bunch of indicators that you're going to use to hire people based on experience and all kinds of other things. And one of the things that we find most often that has the most proof of the pudding, or some would say, is CTF programs, right? So we want to bring more researchers onto the platform. We know there's a ton of new blood out there. If you look at things like CTF time and a whole bunch of other, you know, just like if you pull Twitter for all of the InfoSec CTFs that are happening, these are people that prove that they have the technical skill to work or the aptitude to learn. And we're just always looking to build the crowd up. So we're going to be launching our own CTF program to grab these people, incentivize them, have a little bit of fun. The one thing we also find is that this first step into bug bounty can be a little daunting for any researcher.
I wondered about that, right? Because, you know, there are so many people scooping away the low-hanging fruit, right? Like that, people often say it's a good place to start, a bug bounty, but it's, you know, it's hyper-competitive and not really a collaborative atmosphere when there's money on the table and, you know, like a CTF that actually lets people find some, you know, some issues that haven't been immediately pounced on sounds like a reasonable idea.
Yeah, that's exactly one of the things we're trying to address with it, is this is a little bit of like this stepping stone to bounties, right? CTF, you know something's vulnerable, you know that you have a skill set to find it, and, you know, in the next couple months, you'll have a place where you can onboard, check it out, do some security-based challenges. We know that you have the technical chops to do it, and we can get you onboarded and fast-tracked into the platform quickly. And then you get into the crowd, and there's not a lot of that fear and doubt. One thing I will say about the fear and doubt, though, is that, you know, we constantly receive reports on old targets that people think are hard targets or have been out there too much, and the intimidation factor almost stopped them from testing on them. And we constantly see P1s come through because code changes so fast on our client sites.
It does.
So we definitely prompt people to take a look at those programs still.
All right. Well, Jason Haddix, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to tell us about all the new stuff that's happening over there at Bug Crowd. It sounds very interesting, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, Patrick.
That was Jason Haddix of Bug Crowd there. Big thanks to Bug Crowd for sponsoring this week's show. You can find more info on Bug Crowd's hybrid pen test bug bounty programs in this week's show notes. But that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.